It's a new economy, and the fastest growing fields don't pay enough to live.
They posted $5.5 billion in profits, compensated their CEO $13.7 million, yet pay these very low wages, and on their own cost the public taxpayer $1.2 billion a year.
I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. If you grew up before the recession, you may not have a true picture of what today's economy is. Teenagers used to get minimum wage summer jobs, and occasionally those jobs led to careers. According to a new study by the National Employment Law Project in Washington, the fastest growing number of jobs are in fast food and other minimum wage jobs. But the people who are holding those jobs are older, and they're forced to turn to public assistance because they can't make ends meet. And that cost falls on taxpayers. There were strikes by fast food workers in August, and most recently Walmart workers in more than a dozen cities walked off the job demanding better wages. Sadeh Gebrselassie is a staff attorney at the National Employment Law Project.
We've been looking at the labor conditions in the fast food industry over this last year. We have found in previous reports, for example, that upward mobility in the industry is very limited, that median pay is extremely low, it's less than $9 an hour. And our most recent report looked at the public cost that these low wages put on the taxpayer. And we looked at the 10 largest fast food companies and found that collectively they cost the public taxpayer about $3.8 billion a year in terms of the public assistance that their workers are forced to rely on because they're making such low wages, because they're making median wages of $8.69 an hour. And we contrasted that with the incredibly high profits and CEO pay that these companies are paying their executives. And so if you look at a place like McDonald's, for example, they posted $5.5 billion in profits last year, compensated their CEO $13.7 million last year, yet pay these very low wages, and on their own cost the public taxpayer $1.2 billion a year.
And do you have a sense what percentage of those workers are actually getting public assistance because they can't make ends meet?
We found, our companion researchers found, that more than half of families of fast food workers are enrolled in one or more public assistance programs, and that is double the rate of the workforce as a whole, which is really extraordinary. And the cost of this public assistance to the taxpayer, we estimate, is about $7 billion a year. And so what this shows us is that not only does the fast food industry pay very low wages, the median wage for a frontline worker in this industry is less than $9 an hour, but it shows that whether or not you work in this industry, whether or not you eat fast food, this type of low-wage business model is costing everybody because, you know, taxpayers are the ones picking up the slack for these very low wages that these highly profitable corporations are paying their workers.
And this, of course, brings us to the debate about raising the minimum wage. There are opponents who will say we cannot make corporations do this. They can't afford it. And on the other hand, you've got studies like yours showing that people who are making a very low wage but are working cannot make ends meet on those wages.
Right, exactly. We are the taxpayer. And I think your point about the minimum wage, I mean, it is key because fast food is one of the fastest growing industries in today's economy. And fast food, along with other low wage service sector work, has really been the type of jobs that are disproportionately fueling job growth in our economy. And so we have to figure out a way to raise pay scales in these jobs that are, you know, the jobs of the 21st century, because, you know, while we lost a lot of decent-paying jobs during the recession, jobs in industries like construction, manufacturing, the jobs that are disproportionately fueling job growth today are these jobs in retail, fast food, home health care, where pay is very low, that are occupied disproportionately by women. And one reason why pay is so low is because we have not taken steps to raise the minimum wage. The minimum wage on the federal level is $7.25 an hour. It is way off its historic value. It would be almost $11 an hour had it just kept pace with the cost of living over the last 40 years. And so the failure of policymakers to raise it has been a key reason why pay has been dragged down in the fast food industry and in other low-wage industries. The thing about the minimum wage is that it just sets a floor, right? I mean, it is a floor under which wages cannot fall. But beyond that, and one of the things that we're seeing with this recent wave of fast food strikes is that workers can come together and organize for higher wages above whatever the federal minimum wage floor happens to be. You know, the $15 an hour that the fast food workers have been striking for and demanding, I think, comes much closer to what it would realistically take to support yourselves and support your family. One of the things about the fast food strikes that has been, you know, really illuminating for a lot of people is that these are not teenagers. You know, the median age for a fast food worker is 29 years old. A third of them are supporting families. You know, they are trying to make ends meet and support families on very low pay.
And that's a huge change I'm not sure everyone has paid attention to. Many of the faces that you see doing the low and minimum wage jobs are not teenagers anymore. They are older people, and teenagers can't find jobs at all.
Exactly. I mean, broadly, across the low-wage workforce, 88% of people who work in jobs that pay less than $10 an hour are over the age of 20. So the low-wage workforce is a workforce that is increasingly dominated by adults. Many of them are spending their careers in these industries. If you look at retail, fast food, home health care, some of the fastest growing occupations over the next decade, those are jobs that are occupied mainly by adults, disproportionately women, and, you know, many people that are trying to support families. So, it's a myth that these jobs, these low-wage jobs or minimum-wage jobs are occupied by teenagers. Those are where the jobs are in today's economy, and once you're in the industry, opportunities for upward mobility are very difficult because the fast food industry is very flat. Just 2% of the jobs are managerial. The vast majority are these frontline positions that pay less than $9 an hour. And so one of the things that we saw during the strikes were interviews with workers who had been working at the same fast food establishment for over a decade, and we're still making a single-digit hourly wage because, you know, no matter how good of a worker they were, no matter how much experience they had, there was simply no way to move up. And so I think that points even more to the need to figure out how to raise pay for these frontline positions where literally millions of Americans are going to be spending their careers in. For many people, not only is that their first job, but it's their only job for years, because the better-paying jobs that we saw in the 20th century have disappeared, and many of them are not coming back.
And part of the debate about minimum wage and these low-paying jobs is simply that we are living in the memory of a world that no longer exists. It used to be that a teenager would get a job at a fast food place and get experience and move up the ladder and possibly even move up within that corporation. Or those were jobs for people with no higher education, and even that is no longer the case, you're telling me.
A third of fast food workers have some college education, and so, you know, the other point that the opposition makes is that, well, you know, these are jobs that are low-skilled, et cetera, but it's not, you know, the focus should be on raising pay where, you know, people are spending their careers in, and we did this back in the 20th century. I mean, there was a time when the manufacturing jobs in the Midwest were very dangerous, very, very low paying, and through organizing, you know, we were able to make them into jobs that you could actually build a middle class life on. And I think, you know, it's very short-sighted for opponents to, you know, say, oh, these are low-skilled jobs and jobs that people are going to leave soon, when in fact that's not the case, and we need to figure out if we want to have a healthy economic recovery that, you know, isn't built on a house of cards and we don't, you know, end up in the same situation where we were a few years ago. We have to figure out a way to make these jobs of our new economy, good-paying jobs.
Sadeh Gebrselassie is a staff attorney at the National Employment Law Project.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Coming up, an outspoken Afghan woman who says the best thing the U.S. can do for her country is get their troops out now. And despite a recession, Ireland's committed to doing what it can to help the hungry around the world. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% Archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1269. The U.S. plans to withdraw its troops from Afghanistan by the end of 2014, though so-called special forces will stay there through 2024. Afghan President Hamid Karzai said the U.S. wants to keep 9 bases in Afghanistan, a number the White House has not confirmed. But one Afghan woman continues to speak around the globe, demanding that the war in her country end now. Malulai Joya is an Afghan politician and author and a former elected member of the Afghan parliament.
I'm here that to bring the message of my people, and the only message and the first demand of my people is now the withdrawal of these troops as soon as possible, because our people fed up from this disgusting war, this criminal war in Afghanistan. As presence of these troops is making much harder our struggle for democracy, women rights, human rights by empowering these reactionary terrorists, Taliban and warlords and these drug lords as what they did this 12 years. And you may hear recently that in Jalalabad, their young boys aged to 12 to 20 years old, they are going for hunting, and these foreign troops, they do airstrike and killing them. Three of them, these young boys, they martyred, and there was a huge demonstration. People had the dead bodies of these sons and asking for withdrawal of the troops, while many times happened in different parts of Afghanistan, such kind of resistance of people, resistance of democratic-minded people against occupation, resistance of the democratic-minded parties that we have there, like Solidarity Party of Afghanistan. You can see their website, how they are brave and active there and how people support them. And also resistance of students of the university that, for example, student of the university, 19 members of his family in one day has been killed when these U.S. troops, they did bomb this blind bombardment in Farah province in Balabluk district. All these other students together with the banners come out on the streets of Kabul, and they had demonstration for withdrawal of the troops. And this list can be prolonged, that mainstream media never gave reports of these such kind of resistance. As I said, they are there for their own strategic economic interest. And they even push more Afghanistan toward Stone Ages, like they're inviting Taliban now, these terrorists of the Stone Age, to join this puppet corrupt mafia regime. And the situation will be more disaster, more bloody for my people, especially that nowadays they are raising this propaganda that if the troops leave, civil war will happen. But nobody is talking about today's civil war. The current civil war is going on there. It's still there. It's like civil war. And the future civil war that they are talking, I'm sure, will not be more dangerous than this one. And behind of this propaganda is also the hand of the U.S., first of all, and these other Western governments that who have their own dirty agendas in my country. They make afraid my people that to accept their military bases to be legalized there, otherwise civil war will happen. As U.S. has two faces and very hypocrite. From one hand, they say they are talking to our people about the withdrawal of their troops, but from another hand, they are talking about U.S. permanent military bases there. As right now, they are working on 9 major military bases in my country. Itself is enough to show the hypocrisy of the U.S. government. Same like what they are doing now in Syria. From one hand, they say we are fighting against Al-Qaeda, but from another hand, they support and giving weapons and arms to the fundamentalists in Syria to fight against dictator Bashar al-Assad to bring them in power, or what they did under the umbrella of the UN in Libya, interfered in the internal issues of Libya. And this list can be prolonged, that U.S. day by day waging the war. But fortunately, justice-loving people of the U.S., we see that day by day they stand up more against the warmongers of their government. We need more their solidarity. And now, few thousands of the troops, they will withdraw. In the meantime, they are making more powerful their puppet regime and making legalize their military bases, then to deceive people around the world that we will go out of Afghanistan. Then even easier for them indirectly control my country. No nation can donate liberation to another nation. We are the one that we can build our country. And my people, they can fight these terrorists, Taliban, these medieval-minded warlords, drug lords, all these terrorists, if U.S. and NATO stop empowering these reactionary terrorists who are great obstacles for us. So telling the truth, to do a struggle, not sit silent, never to compromise, especially to be a woman, it is not easy in Afghanistan. That's why 7 assassination attempts these terrorists did against me. With very bad words, dirtiest words, they are threatening me to rape. And even when I was in parliament, they threatened me to rape. And they are, as they are raping the girls. Nowadays, I'm following the case of Shakila, 16-year-old girl, who has been raped and shooted by a member of the provincial council of Bamiyan province. And 3 other members of the parliament, the warlords, are partner in this crime and even tried to forge the medical report of the raped girl. And nowadays, this mafia court that we have trying to end the this case in the favor of the rapist. And I'm there to following such kind of cases, giving helping hand to these victim girls, giving them hope and more courage, and continue this struggle together with my people against all these extremist fundamentalists there who are in power with the mask of democracy and now negotiating with the terrorist Taliban, and also against occupiers. Talking about democracy, women rights, human rights, or free election is just a painful joke.
Malalai Joya is an Afghan politician and author and a former elected member of the Afghan parliament. A UN and World Trade Organization agency is working to make global connections, bring together fashion and fair trade by connecting artisans in developing countries with industry professionals. Those textiles, beadwork, and other traditional crafts are used to produce clothing and accessories. The goal of the International Trade Center, or ITC, is to empower women and support small businesses in the developing world gain access to global markets. UN Radio reporter Diane Penn spoke with its new executive director, Arantxa Gonzalez, in New York.
International trade has enormously opened in the last decades. And yet for many of these companies, it is virtually impossible to trade because their capacity to produce goods and to generate services that are going to be traded internationally is limited. Sometimes this is the result of questions relating to quality. Sometimes it's about this company is not meeting international standards, food standards, health standards, technical standards. Sometimes they have great products, but they just don't know how to market them. Sometimes they know how to market them, but they just have not been able to find the buyers. So it's helping the small and medium enterprises from development of the idea to bringing that particular good or product to an international market.
Tell us about how you're doing that. What ways are you helping them?
Well, we're helping them in a very hands-on manner in essentially 3 ways. First way is by providing small and medium enterprises with what we call market intelligence. We tell them where are the opportunities for them, which are the markets that are growing for which products. The second part is working with agents on the ground, chambers of commerce, associations of producers, cooperatives, trade and investment promotion organizations that are going to be building capacity in these smaller and medium enterprises to trade. And the third way in which we help SMEs is helping them directly with programs, with solutions that would act directly on their competitiveness. It can be by explaining to them marketing techniques, by developing labeling scheme, by helping them improve the quality of their products. So it can be in a thousand different ways.
Of course, now we're in this process of looking towards the period post-2015 and developing a sustainable development agenda. What role do you see them playing in the coming decades?
Well, what we are seeing is the small and medium enterprises being the untapped growth potential that the post-2015 development agenda should focus on. A big part of the 500 million new jobs that will be required between now and 2030, I repeat, 500 million new jobs, will be generated by small and medium enterprises. In many developing countries, SMEs are responsible for 80% of the jobs. So what we must make sure, if we want this growth potential to be unleashed, if we want to reduce poverty, we have to make sure we help the small and medium enterprises be in a position to take advantage of these trading opportunities. One of the commitments that companies take when they sign the Global Compact is to source a certain percentage of their goods or services from women-owned enterprises. And this is one of the many programs that the International Trade Center has. It's a program where we build platforms where women-owned small and medium enterprises in the South can join into buyers, bigger generally in size, from the North or from the South, who have as a commitment to help women empowerment. Again, a very concrete way of making sure that we connect business, and through connecting business we empower women, and through that we create development opportunities, and through that we reduce poverty.
Arantxa Gonzalez is the new executive director of the International Trade Center. That interview came to us courtesy of UN Radio. Finally, the global recession isn't leading to austerity cuts everywhere. In the Republic of Ireland, in fact, the government says the economy is looking better and it plans to share the wealth. Deputy Prime Minister Eamon Gilmore spoke before the UN General Assembly last month.
Gilmore, who is also the country's foreign minister, said his government has prioritized hunger and malnutrition in its aid programs, with plans to double spending on nutrition by 2016. He reported that Ireland is emerging from the crisis and an international bailout, and that its economy is back on track.
And I am proud to say that despite the extremely difficult circumstances many Irish people found themselves in, we have sustained our commitment to the provision of development aid. I know that we are ready to play our part in a new global partnership, and that it is only through this body, the United Nations, that this can be achieved.
The Deputy Prime Minister said creating a better future for the millions of impoverished people worldwide is perhaps the greatest moral and practical challenge facing the international community. He pointed out that more than 800 million people live in extreme poverty, while nearly 20,000 children die each day from preventable causes. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% Archives, go to our website at WAMC.org. If you'd like to connect with us on Facebook, you can find 51% there, and you can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.